This is a closed-circuit feed and not for broadcast. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On today's show, I talk with best-selling author Erica Jong. Her best-known novel, Fear of Flying, was inspired by the feminist movement. Her new book, Serenissima, follows a movie star as she travels between medieval and modern-day Venice. Also today, film director Stephen Frears talks about bringing the life and death of gay playwright Jo Orton to the screen. Frears' film, Prick Up Your Ears, follows up his critically acclaimed movie, My Beautiful Laundrette. Accordionist William Schimmel of the Tango Project shows us that his instrument is good for more than just polkas. And with Mother's Day upon us, critic at large Laurie Stone takes a look at two books about mothers and daughters. That's all coming up on today's Fresh Air. Erica Jong has been my guest. She's a novelist. Her books include Fear of Flying and her new novel, Serenissima. This is Fresh Air. On the next edition of Fresh Air, we'll feature a live concert with singer Peggy King, celebrating the 99th birthday of Irving Berlin, so I hope you can join us. Funding for Fresh Air is provided by a grant from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional funds come from NPR member stations and the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia. This is NPR, National Public Radio. This is a closed-circuit feed and not for broadcast. I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Coming up, film director Stephen Frears discusses his new movie, Prick Up Your Ears. The movie follows the life of gay British playwright Jo Orton, who was murdered by his lover. Also, critic at large Laurie Stone examines two books that explore the relationship between mothers and daughters. Accordionist William Schimmel will demonstrate the little appreciated versatility of his instrument, and we'll get the latest news from NPR in Washington. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. Time for the news. This is Fresh Air. That's the Tango Project, a group dedicated to the revival of the tango and other Latin song forms. Accordionist William Schimmel is one of the co-founders of the group. His playing is also reviving interest in the accordion. He's inspired a newfound respect for an instrument that's usually associated with the Schmenge brothers and schmaltzy renditions of Lady of Spain. We invited William Schimmel and his accordion to our studios the other day. He strapped his instrument on and prepared to play, but he paused for a moment to tell us that his instrument always seems to have a mind of its own.
Whenever I play something on the accordion, no matter what it is, the accordion always wants to change it for me. So even if I'm playing Bach, a Bach prelude or a Bach fugue, all of a sudden the accordion may want to go into salsa or some Latin rhythm. And all of a sudden, I have a whole new piece. Bachianus Argentinus, we could call it, actually. Or if I'm playing Beethoven, a malanga may emerge, which is a kind of a little bit of a tango. Recomposing pieces isn't really anything new. We know that Liszt did it back in the 19th century, and Busoni did it. And they called their works fantasies, especially their keyboard works. And I like to call my works realities. Because when you play these things on the accordion, even if you know the tune or know the melody, or you think you know it, what happens, the accordion translated into a direct experience. It is so gut level, it is so emotional, that the only thing you can call it is reality. It is so direct. And as a matter of fact, you know, even Kurt Weill, speaking of really gut level and direct, even Kurt Weill rewrote some of the songs of Bertolt Brecht and redid them. As a matter of fact, Mack the Knife is one of them, and he orchestrated it and did a lot of elaborations on it. Now, let's say if I took Kurt Weill's favorite rhythm, the tango, one of mine as well, and I added the Grieg Piano Concerto, and I added the Tchaikovsky Piano Concerto, and the Warsaw Concerto, or our favorite 19th century war horses, let's see what we come up with, or let's see what the accordion would come up with.
Thank you.
That's musical reality. Have a good day. This is William Schimmel.
Accordionist William Schimmel is a co-founder of the Tango Project. Recently, he co-created and performed in The Road to Patagonia, a two-person show in New York, tracing the evolution of the accordion in vaudeville. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live from WHYY in Philadelphia and is distributed by National Public Radio.
My guest is filmmaker Stephen Frears. His new film, Prick Up Your Ears, is getting a lot of attention. It's about the sensational life and violent death of English playwright Joe Orton. The film is adapted from John Lahr's biography of Joe Orton and Orton's own diaries. 20 years ago, Orton was bludgeoned to death by his lover Kenneth Halliwell. Halliwell then killed himself. When Orton died at age 34, two of his full-length plays had become hits on the London stage. His plays were black comedies that satirized the English middle class. Theatergoers were probably unaware of Orton's own unconventional sexuality. At the time, homosexuality was outlawed in England. Stephen Frears is no stranger to films about outsiders. His popular film, My Beautiful Laundrette, is about people who are out of the mainstream because they are poor, foreign-born, or gay. I asked Stephen Frears why he thought the story of Joe Orton would make an interesting film.
He wasn't in the heroic mold, so it wasn't he wasn't a sort of James Dean figure at all. He didn't drive fast cars or anything like that. But he did live his own life, and it was an odd life. When the Sex Pistols became famous in England in 1976 or whatever it was, there was a T-shirt that was made in the shop where they came from. And they had a list of people they liked and people they didn't like. And Joe Orton was on the list of people they liked. Well, they can't have seen his plays. And I shouldn't think they knew a great deal about his life. The diaries, I think, hadn't been published then. But he'd somehow worked his way into the mythology of the young, as though he was someone who didn't conform, who lived his own life, and was sort of prepared, I mean, for the violence of his end.
The relationship between Joe Orton and his longtime lover, Kenneth Halliwell, ends in a murder-suicide.
Yes.
Some viewers will see Prick Up Your Ears as a cautionary tale about the price of promiscuity and decadence. Is that an accurate reading of your movie?
Well, it isn't. It is true that they die at the end of it, and Joe's life was very promiscuous. It's not at all the reading that I'm interested in, of course, because I find the relationship much more sympathetic than that and much more complex than that. And in fact, since in the film we parallel a conventional heterosexual marriage with their relationship, of course we would say that we're trying to say things about all couples.
In some films with gay characters, there's no sex on screen. It's left, quote, tastefully off screen. In your film, well, in Prick Up Your Ears, there's no frontal nudity, but there's passionate and juicy tongue kissing,
yes,
and there's some crotch rubbing. Did you think of yourself as brave putting that in the film?
No, not at all. It seemed to me that I neither wish to make a pornographic film or an explicit film, but equally, if you'd made a coy film, it would have been sort of silly, wouldn't it? So you'd do it as sensibly and as gracefully as you can. And my position is absolutely the same as anyone in the audience, of not wanting to be embarrassed or attacked, but wanting to understand the relationship. And at all the all the scenes in the film that involve sex, there's always something else going on, whether it's excitement, whether they're going to be caught by the police, whether it's something else going on. So you didn't have to dwell on the obvious. You wouldn't want to be sentimental and you wouldn't want to be exploitative. It's not made from an outside point of view. It's trying to understand it from the inside.
What did you do to really get that inside understanding?
Well, I read the John Lowe's book and I read the script and I talked to the actors, and I'd grown up in the world in London where I knew a lot of the people that Joe was involved with, and I'd seen people who were involved in the theatre and in living gay lives, and their lives seemed remarkably similar to mine. And so I really used the experience I had and a sort of rather commonsensical approach to it all.
When you were auditioning for the movie, did you have to explain to the actors that they'd have to have, the two main male actors, that they'd be involved in kissing scenes? I'm thinking in America, a lot of actors have been afraid to be associated with gay roles for fear that the public would think that they're gay. Hollywood has just always been afraid of homosexuality.
Yes. Since I was dealing with public material, I mean, the actors involved knew what was, you know, they knew what they were letting themselves in for. And I said, look, I cast both the boys on the same day, and I said, look, you have to play these scenes, and they're not going to go away, or they're not going to, you know, we have to do them properly. And they said, yes, we quite understand. And I said, you know, and they liked each other, and, you know, and I mean, they were both very, very sensible about it.
The casting in the movie is quite extraordinary. Americans know Gary Oldman through his performance as Sid Vicious. Yeah. A drugged-out punk rocker. And that performance is so different than the self-confident, mocking playwright in Prick Up Your Ears. To me, he was just unrecognizable. What did you see in him that made you realize he would be right for the role of Joe Orton?
Well, he has got a rather chameleon-like quality, and he's actually a rather sort of pale, elusive fellow as a, you know, in real life. He's a very, very good actor. And the things you describe, that sort of mocking sexiness, he'd got all that. He had plenty of that. He was sharp and angry and all of those things. It wasn't very difficult to cast him. The man who plays Halliwell was a greater sort of leap.
Yeah, Alfred Molina, who plays Orton's lover, Kenneth Halliwell, is terrific as the dejected, self-conscious, insecure lover who's jealous of Orton's talent and his acclaim.
Yes.
Now, how did you cast him?
Well, he's a very vulnerable man, Fred, and he looks rather extraordinary. And he is a very, very good actor. I think it was... I mean, largely these things are instinctive. Certain things about him made me believe in the character. I mean, Halliwell was a very grotesque figure. I mean, he lost all his hair. He was very, very embarrassing. He used to make an absolute fool of himself in public places. And Fred is a rather conspicuous figure because he's so tall and large. And I imagine quite vulnerable about his appearance in many respects.
You had to, in the direction, bring out a certain grotesqueness in Molina's face. And I was thinking that here's this man who's probably quite striking and really pretty attractive. But because of all the self-hatred that's in the character, the actor starts to look unattractive and kind of grotesque.
Well, if you shave someone's head, they look pretty dreadful. It doesn't help. But he's actually a very attractive man, yes.
Is it ever hard work to make an actor seem unattractive like that, or do they ever resist
you? Well, he knew that that was part of the job. I mean, he's a very sympathetic actor. And since we were trying to make the film with sympathy for that character, I suppose it's quite sensible to cast somebody who is actually a very, very lovable man. But he's much too serious an actor, much too disciplined an actor. I mean, he knew that the character was very unattractive, and he went out of his way to play that side of it. He wasn't at all afraid of it.
Prick Up Your Ears is the second film that you've done that has gay characters in it. Do audiences assume that, therefore, you must be gay?
No, I don't think anybody assumes that. I think they're more perplexed. I mean, I've got dozens of children. I mean, it's true, not that means anything, but... I've never been asked the question, really, but I don't think anybody thinks I am.
Do you think a film like this would be riskier for a gay director because then they'd be typecast in a way as doing movies about gays?
I don't know. Somebody asked me that the other day, and I don't actually see why. I mean, after all, that gay directors make films about straight people, so I don't quite see why a gay director couldn't have made this film. There is a sort of myth that you should cast straight actors to play gay parts, but I don't quite see why it would follow, and I imagine there's plenty of instances that would break that rule.
In Prick Up Your Ears, Joe Wharton accepts an award and says that his plays are about characters who are getting away
yes.
with it, and that he's been getting away with
yes,
it for years.
I have
years.
A very strong sense of that.
It's the innocents who get it in the neck. But that all seems pretty true to life to me, not a fantasy at all. I've got away with it so far, and I'm going to go on.
Now, you've been making, at least for the movies we've seen in America, you've been making pretty personal, eccentric movies in a time of creeping homogeneity.
Yes.
In film, do you feel like you've been getting away
very, very much so. It's very odd. A journalist asked me that the other day. He said, times are supposed to be very bad now. Why is there such goodwill towards this film? I can't explain it. I mean, like, see, they are very eccentric films, and I've always made rather eccentric films. I've no idea. I do feel very much that I've been getting away with murder. And someone said to me one day, a policeman will knock on my door and say, you can't go on making films like these.
Stephen Frears' new film is Prick Up Your Ears. Just before Joe Wharton died, he completed the first draft of a movie commissioned by the Beatles. The screenplay was discovered in 1985, and the rights were bought by producer Joe Papp. He plans to bring the musical to Broadway next year. This is Fresh Air. You can hear full coverage of the news on today's All Things Considered. Renee Montaigne, who co-hosts the program, is joining us from Washington. Hi, Renee.
Hello.
It's been a big news day, what with Gary Hart withdrawing from the race for president.
Well, Terry, with Gary Hart dropping out of the race, we have reports both looking back to see what went wrong and also ahead to see what's next for the Democrats. Also, there are reports that Syria plans to join Israel and Jordan in a Mideast peace conference, and we'll have stories on that possibility and also the Israeli government's reaction to it.
And who will you be speaking with?
Well, I spoke earlier today with Jerry Wexler, who produced Aretha Franklin's big hit, Respect. It first made the charts 20 years ago this week, and it was a major crossover hit. So we'll hear the song, R-E-S-P-E-C-T, and we'll talk to him about how he did it.
Thanks, Renee. Those stories and more are coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Let's hear from our critic at large, Laurie Stone. Today she looks at two books about mother-daughter relationships. Laurie says the authors, Mona Simpson and Vivian Gornick, have a timely and honest approach to the subject.
I just read two marvelous, unsentimental books about mothers and daughters, and they got me thinking about how rare this depiction is. One is a novel, Mona Simpson's Anywhere But Here. The other, Fierce Attachments, is Vivian Gornick's memoir of her Bronx youth. In most of what we read and see, mother-daughter relationships are distorted. We're not given a chance to see the central place this connection occupies in women's lives. And in movies and on TV, the relationships are generally too benign. One of the biggest fibs on daytime soaps is that the moms are always so chirpy and supportive of their girls. By the way, I have to admit, it's one of the reasons I love soaps. But true-to-life obsessiveness does crop up from time to time. It's all over the film Terms of Endearment and the public feud now raging between Betty Davis and her daughter. The players in these dramas, however, have little insight into what drives them. They're just in the grip. Simpson and Gornick, on the other hand, who've had the benefits of psychoanalysis and 20 years of feminism, are able to portray mother-daughter passions without apology or vengeance. And this mastery of the subject puts it in a new light. Adele, the mother in Anywhere But Here, is 32 when we meet her. She's uncertain and ambitious, fragile and overbearing, a woman without boundaries. She even cajoles Anne, her 10-year-old daughter, to skip out nude in front of friends. Anne, who tells the story, stays on guard, making herself precocious. Her awareness feels like a defect, bad breath, or worse, a missing faculty for love or trust. She counts the days until she can grow up. In the meantime, she helps her mother, frustrates her, and takes on her ways, the only ways she knows. What gives this book its heightened, almost surreal intensity is that Simpson trains all her fine intelligence on ordinary anguish. She's fearless, completely candid. Reading Anywhere But Here is like learning a secret from a relative that unlocks the mysteries not only of one's own family, but family life. In Fierce Attachments, Vivian Gornick also levels her sights at a mother who awes and ensnares her. She remembers a knot of women in the Bronx calling to each other across the back alley as they reel and wash, organizing tenants and carrying on as communist fellow travelers, smirking knowingly about sex desired and sex coerced. Gornick's mother fancies herself more developed than the others and the possessor of the rarest of commodities, a perfect marriage. It didn't include much sex, however, Gornick lets us know. Papa's love, she confides, did indeed have wondrous properties. It not only compensated for Mama's boredom and anxiety, it was the cause of her boredom and anxiety. The author's goal is to leave ghetto life. By the end of her book, she's made it clear that the ghetto isn't so much a physical place, but one of false sentiment. She arrives at the larger world of unflinching scrutiny and dutifully, adoringly, schleps her mother along. Simpson and Gornick are not protecting mothers from public view, but in telling the truth, neither do they lay out corpses. Every detail supplied by Gornick and by Simpson's narrator, Anne, makes the mother figures realer, less prey to simplifications, and the younger women's dried-eyed clarity saves them from their mother's self-dramatization, that endless casting of themselves as the ones acted upon and never in control of their fates. In Anywhere But Here and in Fierce Attachments, the truth told is something everyone has known, but few before have dared spit out so artfully and so boldly.
Lori Stone is a New York-based writer and critic and is a contributor to The Village Voice. Here's what's coming up on the next edition of Fresh Air. On our next show, I'll speak with exiled Chilean writer Isabel Allende. Her new novel, Of Love and Shadows, is a love story set against the political repression of her country. Jazz critic Francis Davis will review a new recording of Gershwin's Rhapsody in Blue that restores the original instrumentation. And TV critic David Bianculli says goodbye to Hill Street Blues. So I hope you can join us. We thank everyone who helps make Fresh Air possible.
Funding for Fresh Air is provided by a major grant from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting Radio Fund. Additional support comes from NPR member stations and the listeners of WHYY-FM Philadelphia.
Our senior producer is Danny Miller. Our producers are Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, and Naomi Person. Production assistant, Ed Doherty. Engineers, Joyce Lieberman and Audrey Voblaitis. Chris Spurgeon directs the show. Our theme music is composed and performed by Jackie Byard. My name is Terry Gross. Thanks for listening. This is NPR, National Public Radio.